never been introduced that way before. That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ashley. Do people still call you GH?
Not here, but yes.
Is that a thing? Okay. Yeah. I think my wife started that because she asked you how to spell your name and you were like Ashley GH. And then all of a sudden, everybody on campus at JMU called you GH.
That's right, JMU.
That's right. Yeah. That's good. Good morning, Kindred. Kindred mothers? Is that what I'm supposed to call you? Okay. Yes. Good morning, Kindred. So I was emailing with Christina Devesti. And she was trying to explain where this room was in the building. And she like wrote an email giving directions and then gave up halfway through the email and just said, if you see a band of tired mothers, follow them. And I'm coming to you today as a tired father because my wife is on a very fun girls trip down with some friends in Wilmington, North Carolina, which means I'm solo with all four kids. And
they're clever.
Yes, and they have four clever kids. So, tired mothers, tired father. We'll all be tired together. I'm here to talk about the Lord's Prayer, which is a little bit of a, maybe a strange topic. Usually when you are a guest speaker somewhere, or if you write a book about something, you are supposed to, according to publishers, pick something like new and original and fresh, which are not words that describe the Lord's Prayer. It is not new, it is very old. It's not original, it is somebody else's, right? It's not mine. And it's not fresh. It is part of the great history of the Christian church. And so, talking about the Lord's Prayer is sort of like talking about what I would like to call a treasure hidden in plain sight. So, something very familiar. I mean, there are people who do not follow Jesus or believe the Christian Bible at all who have the Lord's Prayer memorized, right? So, it's very, very familiar territory for most people. In fact, there are some people who grew up in, like, liturgical churches who probably almost have, like, semi-traumatic baggage with the Lord's Prayer from being forced to say it over and over and over again. So, I recognize that starting by saying, hey, let's talk about the Lord's Prayer, might not be a great on-ramp. So, let's start with a different on-ramp. Here's a story. Many years ago, in 2012, our family moved from Charlottesville, Virginia, out to Denver, Colorado. And we did that so that I could go to grad school. And at the time, we had a 10-month-old daughter, June, and we were pregnant with number two. The girls are only 15 months apart. So is that experience of having, some of you have had this, like a very young child and then also pregnant with another child, just difficult season of life. So we moved 2,000 miles away from our next nearest relative, and we go from double income, no kids, 1 year, to no income, two kids, within like a 15-month period, okay? So lots of things in life changed and just exponentially became so much more complicated and hard and difficult, financially, emotionally, relationally, just everything, okay? During this season, I begin to notice something. I was in seminary at the time. Seminary is a weird thing to do. Most people don't do it, which is good. Seminary is weird in that you immerse yourself in like all things Christian. Like you're studying the Bible, you're taking these ancient languages with Greek and Hebrew, you're learning church history and systematic theology and all of these things. Like your mind is being crammed full of data about what it means to be a follower of Jesus. Now, I was anticipating this being an amazing season of life. Like, this is where spiritual growth is just going to go from this to this, right? Because I'm going to be learning so much about Jesus and about the Bible and about the gospel and about the Christian faith. Because up until this point in my life, my game plan, my strategy for Christian growth was learning new things, right? Which is not uncommon. Most people approach spiritual growth that way. Like what it means to grow spiritually in your mind equals learning a new thing, a new posture, a new habit, a new something new, and you're going to learn it or you're going to adopt it. And in the adopting and the learning of that new thing, you will grow. So I found that that's not true. In this season, I was learning more new things than I ever had before. And not only was I not growing, not only was I not experiencing any kind of intimacy or closeness with God, but actually the opposite. I was finding my heart growing cold, distant, bitter, kind of callous. not only towards God, but also towards other people. And I realized that I was well on my way to becoming like the worst kind of hypocrite, the kind of hypocrite that we all would like to avoid. And we all know people like this, and I won't ask you to judge them in your minds right now, but you could if you wanted to, where you can think about the kind of people who know a lot of things about God, maybe even who talk a lot of things about God, but they're actually embodied lifestyle and faith is so far from what they know and what they talk about, right? So it's almost like that hypocrisy trajectory is where the things you know are going this way, but your habits and lifestyle are going this way, right? And as that gap gets wider and wider, your hypocrisy just kind of grows and grows. And so with this season of life, I found myself like more equipped than ever before to teach a class on the virtue of patience, and yet less patient than I had ever been before with my wonderful bride and my, at the time, two little girls. And I was more equipped than ever before to teach a class on evangelism and the great missionary call that all followers of Jesus have to go out and proclaim the good news of the gospel. And yet, the amount that I cared for my non-Christian neighbors had never been less, right? So I was well on my way to becoming the worst kind of hypocrite, the kind of person that I would not want to be. And so this sent me into something of a crisis of faith where I was realizing, oh, I don't know how to grow spiritually. I thought I did. And it turns out at that time, like the first 30 years of my life, learning new things kind of worked because I was young and I was growing up. And when you're young and you're growing, you spend lots of time learning new things, and that's just fine. But that will plateau at a point. And I'd be curious, and this might be something you could discuss around your tables later, whether some of you might have hit that point. We're learning new things about God just doesn't do it anymore, right? And spiritually, you just kind of hit that plateau where you go, I could keep reading books. Like, whatever Beth Moore publishes next, I'll just read that. But actually, you are recognizing it's not going to grow. Actually, all it will do is just create an even larger gap between what you know and what you actually practice, right? Okay, so I'm in 2012. I'm in this kind of spiritual crisis while I'm in seminary training to be a pastor. Things are not going well. I've moved my family 2,000 miles across the country. We are lonely. We are broke. Like, stuff is hard. We are in what you might call kind of a wilderness time or a wilderness season. And I was trying to make friends, and I just, by the Lord's kindness, stumbled into friendship with three other men who were all a little bit older than me, which was very helpful. And we used to go out for beer together at Jake's Brew Pub in Littleton, Colorado at 4 o'clock on Mondays. That was our time. And so I found myself sitting at a table with a pint with these three other men. And on this one particular day, I was just complaining. I would like to use a more Christian word like lamenting, but I was not. I was complaining, which is different. And so I'm complaining about how much I don't like seminary, how I'm not growing spiritually, I don't feel close to God, I'm impatient, I'm grumpy, I'm blah, 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 right, all the stuff. And one of these gentlemen, very kindly, kind of leans in and says, hey, you know, what you're describing is actually not a new problem. Actually, followers of Jesus have hit this problem over and over again. Have you ever, you know, Dan, engaged some of the historic spiritual disciplines of the church, things like fasting, things like liturgical prayer, or maybe like the sacraments, like Holy Communion or the Lord's Supper. Things that you do with your mouth, things that you do with your body, external practices that then might actually have an impact on your internal heart. Have you ever tried engaging those? And I pushed back real hard. His name's Brian. We're still friends. But I pushed back really hard and was like, Brian, you're clearly a bad friend and haven't been listening. Yeah. I don't want more stuff. I want to be genuine, authentic. Like, I want in my heart to connect with God in an authentic way. Like, I want my authentic self to connect with God. And that's when Brian delivered to me what I now refer to as the line, where he like leaned in and said in a very kind and gentle voice, Dan, your authentic self is not that great. And I just want to offer that line to you. Maybe you could let somebody say that to you, or you could like turn and, I won't make you like turn and say it to each other, like turn to your neighbor and say, neighbor, your authentic self is not that great. So what he went on to do was offer me some practices, some ways to start when you're not actually feeling very close to God. And the first thing he recommended was praying the Lord's Prayer regularly, like 3 times a day, multiple times a day. And mostly just trusting the friendship, I began to do that. And that actually set me on a path of learning what I would call spiritual formation from the outside in. Practices and habits that you begin to take up and adopt, even if you don't feel like it, even if they don't feel authentic or original or genuine, that then end up kind of melting into you and working their way into the inside and actually end up changing your heart and your mind and your relationship and your intimacy with God. But they don't start that way. They start as simply exterior practices. And I think this is really important because this is actually how God engages his people when he forms his people for the very first time. So if you go with me in your minds all the way back to the book of Exodus, God sets his people free from slavery in Egypt. He brings them through the waters of the Red Sea. And then he takes them to Sinai, and there he gives them the law. He gives them this very robust set of practices. This is how to live as my people. Here's how to relate to me. Here's how to relate to each other. Here's how to relate to the world. Like, the law is God's spiritual formation from the outside in for his people. And he gives that to his people right before he sends them off towards the promised land. But they're not going to get there right away, right? They're going to end up spending 40 years in the wilderness before they cross the River Jordan and make their way into the land of Canaan, which is the promised land. Now, if you just think about that narrative arc, slavery in Egypt, freedom, crossing the Red Sea, receiving the law, this like set of habits, the spiritual formation from the outside in, 40 years in the wilderness, and then on your way to the promised land. If you just take that narrative arc maps onto us for anyone who becomes a follower of Jesus. You're trapped in slavery to sin. God, through the gospel, the good news of Jesus, come to us. God sets us free from slavery to sin. He takes us through the waters of baptism. And then we're on our way toward God's new creation, towards God's renewing and restoring, remaking of all things and creating the earth to be his promised land. But we're not there yet, which means where are we? We're in the wilderness. Now, earlier, just a few minutes ago, I referred to this very difficult season of life in Denver as a wilderness season. And I did that kind of tongue in cheek on purpose, because all of us go through seasons of life where we feel like we are in wilderness seasons. But I would like to say something that is going to initially sound super depressing, but actually, if you embrace it, becomes a deep encouragement, which is you are not in a wilderness season, no matter how hard your life is right now. You actually live your whole life in the wilderness. Wilderness is the defining paradigm for a follower of Jesus. It's where you live life as a follower of Jesus. It's where God meets you as a follower of Jesus. The first sentence of the book is, "You will never get out of the wilderness. Stop trying." And I don't mean that to be like a depressing start, but I actually think there is a strange and kind of mysterious comfort there, because most of us spend most of our time and energy trying to like unwilderness our lives, right? And if you can embrace that kind of bitter but actually kind of good reality that God is not actually going to try to get you out of the wilderness now. He will eventually, but not now, not in this life. Then you can actually direct your attention to other things. You can direct your energy towards what the people of Israel were meant to direct their energy toward to when they were in the wilderness, which is what? The law, like learning how to be God's people, spiritual formation from the outside in, learning how to relate to God and to each other and to the world, even to themselves. Now, our wilderness takes a number of different shapes. And of course, it can be as simple as the difficult things that we all go through. But if we think about ourselves, not just as individuals, but as a community, as a collective, as a society here, then we might say one of the defining features of our wilderness in this particular age is the wilderness of secularism. Now, secularism is one of those slippery words that's very tricky to define. It's so big, it like fits most things into it. So I'm not going to attempt a full-blown definition of what the word secular means. I'm rather just going to name a couple things that I hope will have some resonance with us, and then we'll kind of move forward. So one is that, and this is just going to sound normal, but it hasn't always been normal. In a secular age, everyone perceives a sacred-secular divide, meaning like we think of some things as being spiritual and other things as being not spiritual, right? And we all just think of that as normal. You came to Kindred Mothers, you're kind of like doing a spiritual thing right now, right? But then you're going to go grocery shopping and you're not going to think of that as a spiritual thing, right? And so, and like, just thinking of that as normal is one of the defining features of a secular age, is thinking that there is a spiritual, sacred secular divide. Another feature of the secular age is just a general overall decline in spiritual belief and practice. And I probably don't have to say too much about that. I think it's just kind of something that everyone senses and feels and experiences, which is, like, if you meet one of your neighbors for the very first time and they ask, like, oh, what are you into? And you say one of the things you're into is, like, this. That's, like, not cool, right? That's, you sort of want to keep that to yourself as long as possible. Like, when I'm on an airplane and if I'm talking to the neighbor next to me and they ask, what do I do? I kind of don't want to tell them, right? It's like, it's going to kill the vibe. I have a good friend who's a pastor who, whenever he flies on an airplane and somebody asks him what he does, he says something like, I am a teacher and a counselor who helps connect people to the divine. And people are always like, whoa, there's a job for that? Like, that is amazing. And he's like, yeah. And then they ask questions and he tries to see how long he can string on the conversation before the neighbor is like, wait, are you a pastor? And he's like, yeah. Conversation over. Don't want to talk to you anymore. So that general decline in belief and practice. And then a third feature of the secular age would be that all beliefs are contested. That no matter what you believe, like Christian or not, all beliefs are like chosen and therefore contested. Meaning, whatever you choose to believe in life, you're going to have to choose it. It's not just going to be a given. We don't do givens anymore, right? You have to choose. And the sociological effect of everybody having to choose what they believe about life, the world, the universe, and everything means that the focus and the pressure in your life goes from the whole to the individual, because you have to choose what your life is going to be about and who you are and what you believe and how you're going to navigate your way through the world. Now, when you put that much focus and attention on individuals and on making individual choices about what you believe, everyone, just by default, like, even if you're not a selfish person, you just kind of have to become something of a self-centered, like, self-focused person, because you have to make so many conscious choices about your life. This is why, in a secular age, narcissism and anxiety become the norm. Because you have to think about yourself so much. You have to, just to make your way through the world. Narcissism and anxiety become the norm. Narcissism, an unhealthy focus on the self. Anxiety, unhealthy concern for the self. Now, another kind of fourth and final feature of the secular age is that, if you need kind of a word picture, it's something like an ashy layer of gray clouds that just kind of sit over the world, where you know, sort of, that there's like a moon and a sun and stars up there somewhere. And you can choose to believe in the stars and the moon and the sun, but you like can't see them, and your neighbors might choose to think that there aren't sun and moon and stars up there, because there's just this layer of cloud that just like hangs over everything. If you need kind of like a literary metaphor, I imagine that some of you have read The Silver Chair by C.S. Lewis. I'm reading that with my third kid right now. His name is Wills. He is 7 years old, and he would much rather play basketball with a Nerf ball one-on-one in his room, which we do every night, but also I require that we read. And so we're reading The Silver Chair together, and one of the scenes, like one of my favorite scenes in all of literature, is the scene where these travelers, Eustace and Jill and Puddleglum, best character ever, are down in the underworld. They have made their way deep underground, and they are being held hostage by the Lady of the Green Kirtles, this like evil witch. And she begins to attempt to convince them that there is actually no overworld. There's nothing above the ground. And the way she does it, she throws some incense on the fire, she takes out an instrument, she starts to kind of play it, and then she begins what I would call something of a liturgy, where she begins to say, repeat after me. And she begins to say things like, there is no sun, And the kids say, there is no sun, there is no moon, there is no moon. There never was a moon. And they kind of go back and forth in this liturgical call and response. And what she's doing is she's trying to lull their imaginations asleep. You can't imagine that there is anything other than just what you can see and feel around you right now. And when I read that, I thought, oh my goodness, what a great kind of metaphor or word picture for what so much of life in a secular age feels like. We are all caught up in these kind of cultural and social liturgies where the messages that are being, we're kind of like asked to rehearse and inhabit over and over, are telling us this is all there is, right? There is no sun, there is no moon, there is no God. There is no big meta story that guides and controls everything. Now, if that is what living in a secular age is like, what's the antidote? How do you actually go about waking your imagination up and beginning to actually imagine God, self, others, and world, and then to make your way according to that? And even as I say, even as I use that word imagination, some of you might initially almost kind of cognitively push back and go, can't you start with something else? Why are you starting with imagination? Why not start with beliefs or doctrine or kind of something else, which is where a lot of people start? I want to take like 45 seconds and try to convince you of the importance of your own imaginations. So we tend to think of imaginations as playing make-believe, like your imagination is where you invent things that aren't real. That is actually not how most followers of Jesus have understood the imagination throughout most of church history. We are the exception, they are the rule. The way most followers of Jesus have understood the imagination throughout history is that the imagination is part of what makes you the image of God. Think about the two root words, image and imagination, okay? The fact that you are a creature that has an imagination is part of why you bear the image of God. Therefore, the way that you use your imagination is part of how you access the truth and reality of who God is. You do so in your imagination. Not in imagining things that aren't real, but imagining things that are real, but that you cannot see or feel or touch or access with your five senses. So imagination is incredibly important. We're going to do just a tiny little bit of what I would call biblical anthropology, which is just a fancy way of saying, how does the Bible describe human beings? How do human beings actually work? And this is illustrating the importance of the imagination. From the imagination springs desires. From desires flow actions, which, as you repeat actions, wear grooves into habits. From habits, you then go looking for beliefs to justify your habits. And then once you have beliefs to justify your habits, you go looking for a community to share those beliefs with you. Once you have a community of shared belief, you solidify that into doctrine. Now, I'm going to say that once more, because this is not how we tend to think human beings work. Most of us tend to think, I have things that I believe, and then I go live according to my beliefs. I don't mean to burst your bubble, but you don't do that. And I don't either. No human being does that. We live out of our imaginations. So from the imagination comes desires. I imagine something to be good or beautiful or desirable. I imagine the good life, and then I start to want it. I start to long for it and hunger for it. And then my hunger and longing for that which I imagine to be good, I then start to act on. And since I'm a creature of habit, I repeat my actions and those become habits. Once I have a set of habits and I have something that I want, that I imagine to be good, I then, because I want to be an integrated person, I need some beliefs to kind of back that up. I can't live unintegrated. I have to believe what I practice. So I go looking for some beliefs. And then once I have some beliefs, I realize I need some people around me to support me in this. So I go find a community to share that belief with me. And then once you have a community of people that share belief, we then kind of like those things settle. The concrete stops being wet, it dries, it hardens. Now we have doctrine together. Now, that is not to say that doctrine is unimportant or like untrue or contrived. Far from it. Like, I believe and teach and practice and like there are doctrines I will die for. But we have to realize, like, as human beings, this is how we work. Therefore, if you want to destroy the Christian faith, do you have to attack doctrine? You do not. Just starve the imagination. Doctrine will like die on its own, right? So when the Christian faith gives up, like relinquishes the territory of all the things that work in our imaginations, which is, you might think of it like books and music and poetry and movies and visuals, like, which tend to be not where Christians spend most of their time laboring and working. Like, no wonder doctrine tends to wither away and die, right? Because our imaginations are constantly being shaped and formed in different directions. Conversely, if you want to ignite faith, like if you want to make disciples, if you want to grow spiritually, where should you start? Start with the imagination. Don't start with doctrine. One of the worst things you could do is try to grow spiritually by just learning more doctrine. Has anyone ever like just given you like a big Hawkins book of like systematic theology and been like, this is how you're going to grow? You're like, thanks. Like, this is, I don't want to. Like, do I have to? Like, actually, no, you don't. It's great news. Let's close in prayer. So we live out of our imaginations. And if you're going to do imagination work, prayer is one of the best places to start for a couple reasons. One, prayer is where you begin to imagine what God is like, what you're like, what your life is like, and what good life is out there waiting for you. Like, prayer takes place largely in the realm of the imagination. That's one reason. The second reason, and I'm going to say something a little bit doctrinal here, which is, prayer takes you into conversation with the source of all creativity and beauty, which is God himself, right? So if you're going to do imagination work, one of the best places to start would be prayer. Now, we're doing a logical progression here. If you're going to pray, how do you learn how to pray? The disciples go to Jesus, and they say, Lord, teach us to pray. And Jesus says, go into a room, close the door, close your eyes, and just say the first thing that comes to mind. No, this is the moment where you're supposed to laugh. That's not what Jesus says, right? Jesus does not say that. He says, when you pray, some of you are like, oh, that's right. The disciples go to Jesus and they say, Lord, teach us to pray. And he says, when you pray, say, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. Like, he gives them the Lord's Prayer. The Lord's Prayer is the answer to the question, how do you learn how to pray? So I think it's so interesting that Jesus gives his disciples a liturgy to pray. It's like Jesus knows us better than we know ourselves. Jesus knows that here, this like very simple, deceptively short little prayer is actually going to go to work on the disciples' imaginations. As it works on their imaginations, it's going to work on their desires. As it works on their desires, it's going to work on their habits. As it works on their habits, it's going to work on their community. As it works on their habits and their community and their beliefs, it's then going to establish and become doctrine. And the Lord's Prayer actually contains within it wonderful doctrine. I mean, if you just believed and practiced everything the Lord's Prayer says, you kind of don't really need much else. Like, it's enough. So the Lord's Prayer is this amazing prayer that God has given to us. It's a little bit like, I'm going to quote C.S. Lewis twice, it's a little bit like the wardrobe into Narnia. It's bigger on the inside than it appears to be on the outside. There's more there in the Lord's Prayer than you might think. You might be the kind of person who's prayed the Lord's Prayer like thousands of times, and yet there's more there for you to discover. I know there is for me. Now, the reason why the Lord's Prayer works is because it is subversive. And here I need to introduce a word that Christians don't talk about a lot, but I think we probably need to. So, the Lord's Prayer is subversive. And actually, you could even say it bigger than that. You could say that the Christian faith is subversive. You could say the gospel is subversive. You could say the way of Jesus is subversive. Now, here's what I mean when I say subversive. What I mean is there are a number of different postures that any of us might take in approaching culture and society and kind of all of life. The three normal postures most people take are defensive, passive, or aggressive. Okay? And in fact, one of the things that you could talk about, maybe with friends later on, is just which one of these do you find to be most easy and normal for you? Every human being leans towards one of these: defensive, passive, or aggressive. Here's what I mean. Defensive, if you're a Christian, means that when you look out at culture and society, you see a lot of scary threats. You rightly perceive a lot of scary threats, but your response to those threats is to retreat, is to pull back, maybe build some walls, maybe like find a way to not participate as much in culture and society because of how threatening you experience it to be. And you adopt something of a defensive posture towards the world. Like, your posture, especially if you're a mother with kids, is like, I'm gonna protect my kids from being unduly influenced by things that are bad for them, right? And your posture as a mother becomes primarily like mother defender, okay? So then there's a different kind of person who sees how different, like, our culture and society has become from the historic faith and feels like it's probably the faith that needs to change, right? Like, we probably need to, like, we need to, like, do a rebranding campaign on this whole follow Jesus thing. And we're going to change as much as we can about the faith to, like, fit into, to accommodate as much of culture and society as we can. And that's going to lead you down a very different road. It's much more of a passive posture where you kind of recognize, okay, that's where the stream is flowing. I'm going to go along with it as much as I possibly can, okay? Then there's a third posture, which is the aggressive one, which is you rightly perceive that culture and society is very different from the historic Christian faith. You don't want to pull back and retreat. You know that Jesus calls you to go out. Like, you read the Great Commission and you take it seriously. You're like, yes, let's go. But why are you going? You're going to win. You're going to dominate. You're going to, like, we're going to take the city for Jesus, right? We're going to make everybody a Christian. And it's this dominant, aggressive posture that says, like, we will be victorious, right? Now, the interesting thing about those three postures, even though all of us gravitate towards one of them naturally, none of them are the way of Jesus. Is Jesus primarily defensive? You guys are sinful. Back off. No. Is Jesus primarily passive? Like, whatever you guys want to do, I'm on board. Like, you pray for it, I'll bless it. No. Like, is Jesus primarily aggressive? Does he come to us to conquer us? No. What is the way of Jesus? Well, I would argue it's subversive, even if that's not a word we're used to using or associating with Jesus or the Christian faith. So this word subversive, often when we hear it, we tend to think of, like, Cold War era terror cells. Like, that's kind of what the word subversive inspires. We need to, like, get that out of our minds. So subversive is simply, like, undermining one thing to replace it with something else. And so if you need an adjective to help you, you would say, like, benevolent subversion. So undermining something that's not good to replace it with something that is better. Benevolent subversion. We actually experience subversion all the time. And when it happens, it's very powerful. Like, subversion explains why rom-coms are so good, right? And I actually put this in the book. I am not bringing this up just because I'm speaking at a women's event, okay? So, like, what is the normal story for every great rom-com, right? Like, it's like you're introduced to the characters, they have sworn off dating. They'll never date again, right? The other, like, sex is terrible. And then what happens? Then there's the meet cute moment, right? Where they meet somebody. And even though they swore, even though they, their doctrine is, I am not going to date. That's their doctrine. It's their belief. But then they encounter something beautiful. And which one wins? The beauty or the belief? Beauty wins, right? Beauty trumps belief every time. Always. Because we live out of our imaginations, right? Now, this is why the gospel is subversive. God comes to us. He comes to us in our sin. He wants to undermine our sinful, rebellious ways and replace it with faithfulness, replace it with something much better. How's he going to do it? He's not going to do it by defending or by going passive or by going aggressive. He's going to win us over with beauty. He's going to love us in such a way that he's going to give himself for us. It's going to sweep us off our feet. And it's going to cause us, in his love, to begin to love him in return. This is how the gospel works. Now, this is actually how the whole ministry of Jesus works. This is why Jesus teaches primarily in parables. Parables are an interesting way to teach. I've wondered sometimes whether churches could survive on parables. Like, what if every sermon was just a parable? And, like, your pastor gets up, he or she tells, like, a super confusing story, and then closes. Right? And you just have to, like, think about it for years until you figure out what it means. Like, this is how Jesus teaches. But why does Jesus teach that way? Because parables are subversive. Parables have their own internal logic to them. You can't disagree with a parable. A farmer went out to sow some seed. Some birds came and ate it up. The seed fell on good soil and it grew and produced fruit. There's nothing to disagree with. It's just a story. So you believe it. You believe the parable. And then later you realize it applies to you. Crud. Now I believe something that doesn't fit my life. I feel the dissonance. I feel the lack of integration. And I have to change. The parable has subverted me. It, like, swept the legs. It cut my knees out, right? This is the ministry of Jesus. Now, this is a hypothesis. This is why Jesus gives his disciples the Lord's Prayer. The disciples come to Jesus, they say, Lord, teach us to pray. And Jesus doesn't give them an algorithm or a formula for how to get God to answer prayers, which is what most of the other rabbis in the first century would have been doing. Asking your rabbi how to pray is a very normal question for any disciple to ask. And Jesus isn't the only rabbi in the first century wandering around the Sea of Galilee. Like, other people are doing this, and they're giving different answers. Jesus gives a very unique answer in giving the Lord's Prayer. The Lord's Prayer is subversive. And the church has actually always known this. There's this old Latin phrase that I want to teach you. And I know, like, Anglican priests teaching Latin, we're close to going off the rails here. It's only three phrases. It goes like this. Lex orendi, lex credendi, lex vivendi. And it very simply just says, the law of praying is the law of believing is the law of living. In other words, prayer shapes your life. Prayer subverts your life. You live out of your imaginations. Lex orendi, lex credendi, lex vivendi. So all of that is one giant setup for why the Lord's Prayer is so important and why Christians, followers of Jesus, for literally thousands of years have taken up the practice of praying the Lord's Prayer over and over and over again, seeking to allow the prayer to shape them from the outside in, and then eventually from the inside out. Now, I'm going to end. Do I have like 5 more minutes, or are we done? Yeah? Okay. So I want to end by taking one or two stanzas of the Lord's Prayer and just kind of showing how it works. And then if you want to go deeper and sort of see how all the different stanzas work, you can read the book if you want to, but you don't have to. So let's start with the word hour. First word is the word everybody skips right over. Hardly anybody spends any time thinking about why does the Lord's Prayer begin with the word hour. If you think about it, it's a weird way to start. Who is the hour? Who is who are the other people in the hour? When you begin to address the Lord that way, well, most of you are reasonably intelligent, smart human beings, and so you're probably, and you've been in church before, so you're thinking right now, like, oh, the hour is like Christian brothers and sisters. Like, yes, that's true. Which ones? The ones you like, the ones you don't like, the ones who share your doctrine, the ones who don't share your doctrine. Like, who is included in the hour? There's like, in all times of church history, including our own moment, maybe even especially our own moment, there's the temptation to divide the world into, like, my tribe and then, like, other tribes, right? Mm-hmm. And we tend to think of our tribe as being the people who agree with my beliefs and my doctrines, my kind of take on culture, my take on, you know, kind of what it maybe means to be a follower of Jesus. And I'm comfortable praying with those people. And I'm comfortable praying for other people, right? But do not ask me to pray with those other people. The very first word of the Lord's Prayer is, I think, a deeply subversive word. It confronts you in a sneaky way. First, like, if you're a follower of Jesus who believes Jesus and believes the Bible, then you automatically believe the Lord's Prayer. Like, you don't think the Lord's Prayer is not true. You already think it's true. And you might even start praying it. Maybe you pray it a lot. And then, if you really kind of dig into it, you realize, oh, wait. Even the first word there is inviting me to relate to other people differently than I would naturally relate to them. But it's too late, I already believe it. So now I'm faced with the uncomfortable reality of recognizing that my prayers don't match my attitudes or my lifestyle. Which means either I should stop praying the Lord's Prayer or I'm gonna have to change. So now the prayer's changing if I'm willing to let it. That first word invites us to reimagine God as shared and not personal or distant. There's a familial sense to this. I think most people tend to fall into one of two categories when it comes time to pray. There's this is a little bit cheeky, but there's like the Mr. God Sir people, and then there's the My God people. So the My God people feel a lot of intimacy with God. If this is you, you look forward to your quiet times. You're like, yes, I'm going to get in my chair with like my coffee and my book and my journal and my flower bookmark that I made. It's going to be awesome. Like, I'm just going to like soak in God's presence. And you love this. And you're like, I'm not being like, this is a good thing, right? And then there are people who think those people are crazy, right? And you hear, maybe like other women here, talk that way about the way they spend time with God. And you're like, that is not how it goes for me. I sit in my chair and I don't know what to do. And then I like get distracted and then I check Instagram and then I go do something else. Because it doesn't work, right? And maybe you're more of like a Mr. God sort of person, which is like, I believe in God. He's just way the heck over there. And I'm over here. And I would kind of like those other my God people to maybe pray for me, because they seem to know God in a way that I don't, right? The word our is actually a great challenge to both of those people. To the my God person that loves that close intimacy with God, it says, actually, there's no personal access to God that doesn't immediately include other people. You can't access God by yourself. Not a thing, according to Jesus. And then to the Mr. God sir person who like sees the kind of holy other distance of God but feels like you can't access God, it actually comforts that person and says, you're part of the hour. Like, you are in this family too. And so you don't have to go past that first word before there's already invitations to change the way you relate to other people and the way you relate to God. We'll do one more. Father. A word with some baggage, right? All of us have baggage with the word Father. I do. I assume that you do too. If you and I think that we have baggage with the word Father, if we have some kind of some dad issues, that word Father is actually even more charged and loaded in a first century context in Jesus' time than it is in our own time. When we tend to think of the word Father, we probably are almost only thinking of nuclear family stuff, right? Like that's at least 90% of what all of us are thinking when we hear the word Father. In a first century context, there's a lot more going on. And this is where we're gonna see how subversive the Lord Jesus actually is. So if you're a person wandering around the Mediterranean in the first century, and you ask a random person on the street, who is our Father? That's actually a question people would ask, and there is an official approved answer. Do you know what it is? Caesar. Caesar's our father. Caesar is the father of the empire. That is like, that's normal, common parlance. Anybody in the first century would know that and would be used to hearing that kind of language. Even more than that, think about a first century Roman context. You think about the pater familias, the male head of household. So I've had people kind of challenge me on the Lord's Prayer before, kind of be like, how can you like the Lord's Prayer? It like, all it does is support the patriarchy, right? Because you're being asked to address God as Father. Like, haven't we grown past this? Haven't we progressed past this? If you think the patriarchy is a problem now, think about it in a first century context, where husbands and fathers rule over their households with an iron fist, where their wives and their children and their servants are like literally their property, right? So we tend to have some dad issues, yes, in a first century context. Politically, the word father is charged, and familially, in the family, the word father is very charged. Everybody in the first century has got some trauma around the word father, especially if you're Jewish, like the disciples, because you've been conquered by the Romans, right? Like, the our father, Caesar, is literally the overlord who has conquered your people and has the thumb down, like holding your people, literally oppressing your people. So, when Jesus says, when you pray, say our Father, you gotta imagine the disciples look around each other and go, are you serious? Like, that's how you want us to talk to God? Don't you know the kind of baggage we have with that kind of language, politically and also in our own families? What is Jesus doing? He is inviting the disciples to reimagine God as the kind of Father that we've all always longed for, but that none of us have ever had, right? It's the invitation to reimagine God as affectionate. And it's using language that subverts both like overt nationalism and the nuclear family. There's like two kinds of idolatry that are getting subverted in that phrase. And so if you're a first century Roman Christian, let's say you're a Roman Gentile Christian who converts, and in your converting, you are like beginning to be taught how to pray to God, and people are teaching you the Lord's Prayer, the Our Father. You've been using that language to address Caesar. Now you're invited to use that language to address God. So the prayer itself is telling you, like, God, politics, okay? The prayer is telling that to a first century person. here we are in the DC area, right? It does that for us too. I did my pastoral residency at the Falls Church Anglican just down the road. Some of you will know that, like, George Washington, the father of our country, was like in leadership there back in the day. We love Washington, great guy. But God, politics, right? That's what the Our Father tells us. And then we get in our own little families and it tells us God, family. And actually for someone like me, the God politics thing is no big deal. I'm like, oh, that's great, high five. Yes, absolutely, let's talk less about politics. But I love my wife and my kids. And I grew up in a big extended family with lots of siblings who've all gotten married and had kids. Like, we are one, the Marauders are one of those families that goes to the Outer Banks and they all wear matching white shirts. And they all go take their, like, big family picture on the beach and everybody else hates that family. We are that family, okay? And the Our Father comes to me and subverts the nuclear family and says, no, that is not actually what it means to be family. Like, that's not actually what it means to have a dad or be a dad. And so those first two words have so much contained within them that if we're willing to pray them, if we're willing to engage our imaginations and let it kind of go to work on us, there's a lot of discipleship and formation that will happen even as we begin to pray a very simple liturgy like the Lord's Prayer. I'll conclude with this. I have on my cell phone three alarms that are set to go off every day. One in the morning, one in the middle of the day at noon, and then one in the evening right before I go to bed. And I've had this for years, and whenever those alarms go off, wherever I am, I kneel down and I pray the Lord's Prayer. And this has become a habit that I have taken up over the years, and sometimes it's awkward, sometimes I'm with people when those alarms go off. And I try to be emotionally intelligent, and, like, if they're not going to get it, then I just kind of skip that time. But if they are, if I think they might get it, then I just invite them to pray with me. It's a prayer that I pray with my kids in the mornings. It's often a prayer that I'll pray with my wife, Rachel, before we go to bed. And I just want to offer that to you as a kind of a sample habit that you could take up if you wanted to, especially if you're the kind of person that would like to learn how to pray. Maybe up until this point in your life, you've been trying maybe a lot of different strategies for spiritual growth. And maybe you're in that place where I was a number of years ago, where you feel like that's all just plateaued and you kind of don't know how to grow anymore. Maybe starting with the Lord's Prayer could be good. Could be a good place. I know it was for the disciples, and I know that it has been for me as well. Can I say a prayer for you all? Is that all right? What if we stood up together and we prayed the Lord's Prayer together? Is that all right? I know not everybody has it memorized, and that's okay. I'm going to do the old version with the thighs, okay? If you don't know it, just listen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Amen. So good to be with y'all.
And thank you.